Here. So at 9 minutes past eight, Caroline.
McCabe to help Garda unit with probe. That's the headline in the Irish Examiner this morning, as both it and the Irish Times lead with more on the plans to investigate the sergeant's allegations into abuse of the penalty point system. The Examiner story says that during yesterday's two-hour meeting between Sergeant McCabe, Assistant Commissioner John Toomey and members of the Professional Standards Unit, he was asked to make himself available for a week so that the unit could draw on his knowledge. The Times says the move is for at least a week, and also that the arrangement where a whistleblower is effectively being seconded to the unit charged with upholding professional standards is unprecedented in the Garda. Unprecedented or not, it's welcome, according to the Examiner. The headline over an analysis piece by Michael Clifford advises use the force within. Employing Sergeant McCabe's talents for the betterment of the Gardaí, he says, would show that a genuine effort is being made to change the culture within the force. What, meanwhile, of the effort being made within government to devise a budget strategy on income tax? It makes the lead in the Irish Independent today. Revealed cut to top rate of tax on table in budget is the headline. In the story, Fiona Sheehan says a cut to the higher rate is firmly on the budget table as a way to provide relief to middle-income workers, provided the benefit can be clawed back from higher earners. The average family, he continues, is only expected to benefit to the tune of €300 a year. And he says the relief will be targeted to give the greatest benefit to those on middle incomes. The more a worker earns, the less their tax cut will be worth. The cuts in health spending over the past year, meanwhile, get front page space on the Examiner. Government cooked the books on health budget, says Fianna Fáil, is the headline. The story's about Micheál Martin's accusation yesterday at the start of his party's think-in. We're told he claimed there's evidence officials consciously misled the public and the Dáil over what cutbacks were realistic as part of what he termed a fraudulent financial plan, and he's quoted directly. The whole government is responsible, we're told, he said, and Brendan Howlin is right in the middle of it, throwing figures at health that had no relation to reality. What of the reality which lies beyond the vote in Scotland, meanwhile? The Independent finds front page space for news of a last-minute London rally where celebrity campaigners urged voters to stay part of the UK. Geldof flies union flag as he tells Scotland to vote no, is the headline there. Back in the Times, there's front page space, meanwhile, on the possible new reality for some fee-paying schools. Seven schools may abandon private status, says the headline over a piece which says discussions between that many establishments and the Department of Education are ongoing amid renewed claims that the government's drive for greater equity in secondary education is ending up costing the state more money. Otherwise, this morning, the Irish Daily Star leads with a report on that brutal murder of a British couple in Thailand. Couple hacked to death in paradise is the headline there. The Irish Sun, meanwhile, leads with a report on a woman who they say has told Gardaí she was abducted and raped by a man she met in Dublin on the Tinder dating app. And the Irish Daily Mail leads with a piece on reaction to a retired judge's comments on some rapes being less violent than others. But finally in features, the Mail has a piece celebrating 25 years of Fair City. The Independent has one on 10 unusual ways to really beat work stress. And the Times has one about writers being commissioned to devise new endings to classic novels. And so we get Sheila O'Flanagan's redrawing of Jane Eyre into a rather more feisty creature, one who, on her return to Thornfield Hall to find a blinded, widowed Mr. Rochester, says, "Reader, I did not marry him. My regard for him remained warm, but I was a very different woman. Notwithstanding my feelings for him, I did not look up to him as I had once done, and I could not help but compare how I had dealt with my trials to how he had dealt with his." And so what did she do? Well, she opened a school for foundling girls, and as for romance, dear reader, well, that, O'Flanagan's Jane declares, is another story.
12 minutes past eight. Thank you very much. Welcome back. You're listening to Morning Ireland. At a quarter past eight, the United States has launched airstrikes in support of Iraqi forces fighting Islamic State militants. Meanwhile, in Paris, 30 countries have been represented at a meeting which was intended to further and strengthen and deepen the coalition which is being built to fight the Islamic militants in both Syria, obviously, and Iraq. But there are problems emerging with that coalition or alliance, or whatever way you want to call it. For more on this, we're joined by Fawaz Gurgis, Professor of Middle East Relations at the London School of Economics. Thanks for taking the call. I suppose the obvious problem to begin with is the fact the people who weren't there.
Absolutely. Iran was not there. The Syrian government was not there. The Iraqi leadership was very upset that Iran was not present, because Iran and Iraq have very, very special relationship. Iran has played a key role in trying to help the Iraqi government take on the so-called Islamic State. Iran is the most powerful country in Syria, waging a war against the armed opposition groups, including the so-called Islamic State. Russia has made it very clear, the Russian foreign minister, that the United States does not have any kind of mandate to carry out attacks inside Syria unless it coordinates with the Syrian government. The sectarian divide between Sunni-dominated Saudi Arabia and Shia-dominated Iran overshadows the so-called this important regional and international coalition. There are major problems.
So the Iranians weren't there, and without their involvement, any alliance is going to be seriously weakened. They didn't even mention Syria one way or another because they couldn't agree on what to do there. And they're not sanctioning or approving what the Americans are doing while they talk. So is it possible to look on the positive side of what progress they're making, if any?
Absolutely. I think we should. I think the cup is more than half full. You have a large number of states, both regional and international, that are committed to taking the fight to the Islamic State. Many regional powers are involved and have committed themselves to helping the Americans and the Europeans. Even though Iran was not there, Iran is on the same page with the United States. My take on it is that the Americans would have liked Iran to be present, but of course that would have been costly in terms of convincing the Sunni Arab states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to attend as well. The Americans are talking to the Iranians. This is now, it's an open secret. I think everyone knows, including the Saudis and the Iranians, that the so-called Islamic State represents a serious threat to regional security and their own national security. So there is a convergence of interests among the regional powers, and the United States will basically indirectly coordinate with the Iranians in order to basically make this particular operation against the ISIS or the so-called Islamic State works well.
And yet, how do you view the slow process, inevitably, of alliance building, because there are so many different interests from Russia to Iran who weren't there, the Saudis and so on, while the action is happening? The Americans are bombing from the air already. Can those two processes work and succeed or make any progress while there's this disconnect?
No, I don't think so. I think, I mean, for your own listeners, diplomacy by itself is a very slow process. It's a complex process. Building a complex, broadly based coalition takes time, efforts, investment. It's a testament to Barack Obama, in contrast to his predecessor, George W. Bush. He does not want this operation to be an American or a European led. He is very conscious of the need for multilateral diplomacy. He's been attacked in the United States for the lack of leadership. On the contrary, this man understands that Middle Eastern politics are very complex, that sectarianism is poisoning the veins of Middle Eastern politics, that the United States should work with allies, both Middle Eastern and Europeans. And I think ultimately this particular coalition would be much more effective than an American-led operation or a Western-led operation, even though there are major differences, even though this is the reality. But Barack Obama realizes that for this particular fight to be effective, to be seen as legitimate, to be seen not just as an American or a Western operation, he has to really work with allies and basically nudge his allies and invest with such a coalition. So all in all, I would say it's a plus rather than really a liability.
Professor Gurgis, thank you very much for talking to us.
Scotland has 2 days to decide whether to stay in the United Kingdom or leave for good. Yesterday, thousands of people supported a last-minute rally in central London, where celebrity campaigners urged voters in Scotland to remain part of the United Kingdom. Bob Geldof flew in from America for the rally and told the crowds that all of the UK was disillusioned with Parliament and Scotland needed to stay to help resolve the issue.
And what a construct this thing is, because Scotland is a feeling. England is a feeling. Wales is a feeling. Ireland a feeling. But the United Kingdom is one of the greatest ideas ever invented for the modern age.
British Prime Minister David Cameron made an impassioned speech at a televised gathering in Aberdeen. He promised that if the Scots reject independence, they will immediately get new powers for their existing Scottish government, including major new powers over tax, spending and welfare services.
We want you to stay. Head, heart and soul, we want you to stay. I won't be here forever. If you don't like this government, it won't last forever. But if you leave the United Kingdom, that will be forever.
Also yesterday, Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond, who was urging a yes vote, met with pro-independence business leaders in Edinburgh.
That these Scottish businesses with substantial confidence in the prospects for an independent Scotland. They see the future as creating a more prosperous economy, but also see the importance of holding society together and creating a more just society, and rightly and properly, because as I said, this is the land of Adam Smith, and it was Adam Smith, the founder of economics, but also a moral philosopher who said that no society can be truly happy if a great part of its people are poor and miserable. So it's that social dimension, that the generation of wealth, but also looking to create a fairer society, which is the mark of the almost 3,000 businesses, large and small in Scotland, business people, who've rallied to the Business for Scotland banner.
That's Alex Salmond. Let's speak to our correspondent, Paul Cunningham, who's in Scotland. Paul, the front page of the Daily Record newspaper in Scotland this morning, The Vow, signed by David Cameron, Ed Miliband and Nick Clegg. What are they promising?
Well, what they're promising are extensive new powers for the Scottish Parliament, which will be delivered over a period of time. And what they seem to be trying to emphasise is that Scotland is going to get extra devolution. It's going to have extra powers to be able to deal with issues here in Scotland, while at the same time they remain inside the United Kingdom, and that's going to give them security, that's going to give them stability, that's going to give them the strength. And what they're trying to argue is that you want more control over your affairs, well, we're going to legislate for that, but don't leave the United Kingdom, because then you're on your own, and if you do vote and you do vote to leave, there's no coming back.
So this late in the day, they're offering a third way, essentially. Will it be enough to sway the vote?
Well, that's unclear, and the no's are the yes sides, those who are voting in favour of independence and hoping others will join them, are saying, well, it's still unclear exactly what these powers are going to be. They say it still has to be handed over by a vote in Westminster, and they say Scottish people are effectively crossing their fingers, waiting for crumbs to be dispatched from the table. And they say, why was this promise not made months ago, at the beginning of the campaign, so that Scottish people would know exactly what powers they're going to get and be able to decide therefore whether this was enough? And what they're trying to raise on the yes side effectively is to say, this is uncertain, you've never been able to trust London before, don't trust them now, this is effectively a phantom, this is a promise which is never going to be delivered. And that does have some power, that's a powerful message, but just exactly who's going to believe what the leaders say is unclear. That's going to be decided in less than 48 hours, that's when the polls open.
Paul, you're there. What are people saying? Have they made up their minds, or is this 48 hours enough time to change enough minds to change a vote one way or another?
When I have met people on the streets and been travelling in Edinburgh and Glasgow and Hamilton, you meet two groups of people. One, those who are absolutely convinced as to how they're going to vote, either yes for independence or no, that they're better off staying inside the union. And then there are the others who just don't want to talk, who don't want to say what way they're going to go, who describe themselves as either undecided or just simply don't want to disclose it. In the closing days, it has become slightly embittered. There is accusations of bullying on both sides, and I think there is a large number of people who simply haven't expressed themselves yet. We do have polls. Many of those polls are internet polls, so you're not talking to a person. You're effectively filling in secret in some ways, replicating what's going to happen in the ballot box. And those poll of polls, when you aggregate them all, are still saying it's 51 to 49%. We simply don't know. It's too close to call.
Paul Cunningham in Scotland, thank you. It's 25 past 8.
And we're going next to Limerick, where the body of a woman who died 21 years ago is to be exhumed. For more, we're joined by Midwest correspondent Cathy Halloran. First of all, where is this happening, Cathy, or about to happen?
This is happening as we speak at a cemetery in Rathkeel in West Limerick, and the exhumation was ordered after Gardaí got new information about the death of a woman in Dublin in 1993. Now, she'd been out socialising with friends and went home to her flat in South Dublin and was found dead there a number of hours later. Her death was not treated as suspicious at that time, and an inquest subsequently showed she had died from asphyxiation and as a result of choking. However, subsequently Gardaí received new information about her death after a man who said he met the woman that night and returned with her to her flat spoke to them. Now, Gardaí began their inquiries and spoke to a number of witnesses based on this man's information, people she would have known and also who were with her that night, and started to piece together in a more detailed way an account of what may have happened to the woman that night. Now, as a result of those inquiries, a cold case team from Terenure the station, which is looking at the historical cases, then applied to the Department of Justice to have an exhumation order, and that was put in place last July so that the remains could be examined again. Now, the woman is a native, as I said, of West Limerick, so a team of forensic Gardaí have begun that very grim work at that cemetery in Limerick this morning. The graveyard is being treated as a crime scene while Gardaí carry out this work, which is also being attended and supervised by the coroner in West Limerick, Brendan Nix, who's a barrister here in town. The exhumation, as you can imagine, as everybody can imagine, is very difficult and sensitive work, and they have to be very mindful of the location and not to upset the dignity of the graveyard, particularly for those, that woman's other deceased relatives and indeed other deceased souls, which are located in what is regarded as sacred ground. Now, what happens from here is that the body will be brought to University Hospital in Limerick, and a new post-mortem will be conducted there by the assistant state pathologist, Dr. Michael Curtis. And his results and his work will determine the Gardaí investigation, and if indeed they will begin a new investigation into this woman's death. That being done, it's believed that the body, the remains of the woman, will be returned to the graveyard later today in Limerick.
So the exhumation is taking place in Rathkeel, but as you understand it, the information which led to this exhumation, that came to the Gardaí in Dublin.
Yes, well, that's where the woman lived, and that's where the initial inquiries were conducted into her death. She lived in South Dublin, and it's a team of Gardaí who had been reviewing the case based in Terenure in Dublin. They're now liaising with the coroner here in Limerick, and the work is progressing.
Cathy Halloran in Limerick, thank you very much for that. It's coming up to 28 minutes past 8. Tonight, and Pádraig Lodge is here with the sport. We're not going to ask him what David Beckham had to say about the Scottish referendum, but we are going to talk about soccer.
Yeah, indeed, Carl. Good morning again. Shamrock Rovers are through to the semi-finals of this year's FAI Cup, the most successful club in the history of the competition, although they haven't won it since 1987. They defeated Dundalk 2-1 in last night's quarter-final replay at Oriel Park, behind to a 40th-minute goal from Patrick Hope when they scored twice in the last 10 minutes. Both goals scored by substitute Carroll Shepherd. Now, John Kenny spoke to midfielder Sean O'Connor about the impact that Shepherd made in the game.
Shepherd's come on and he's given us another dimension running in behind. That's what he gives us. I know if we won the ball, he'd be on the defender's shoulder to tread it through to him. He's doing it in training the last 2 or 3 weeks, like he's flying. So all credit to him for putting them away.
Mm-hmm. Tough game tonight, wasn't it? They had you under caution at times in the second half.
Yeah, listen, you know what you're going to get when you come up here on this pitch. Like, I don't think many players in the league are fans of it. You kind of have to go a little bit more direct on it. I think when Steve McPhail came on in the second half, we kind of relaxed a little bit and got it down and tried to play a little bit, and it seemed to suit us. Like, so we didn't stop believing. Half time, we knew the longer we stayed in it, we had a chance. Like, so I think it's 20 odd years since Rovers won it, so that'll give us a little bit of belief now, you know, coming up to a place like this and winning. I think whoever we get in the semi-finals, I think teams will be fair than us now in the semi-finals, to be honest.
Yeah, and when you consider what Friday's game wasn't a great display, it wasn't great to look at, tonight was a much better performance on both sides.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of watching it from the stands on Friday because I was suspended, but yeah, even to be involved in the game, like, it felt like it was a higher tempo to it and stuff. It was enjoyable actually to be involved in. So, listen, again, we're delighted to be in the half for the semi-final.
That's Sean O'Connor. There's another quarter-final replay tonight with Derry City hosting Drogheda United at the Brandywell. In the English Premier League, West Ham twice came from behind to draw 2-2 with Hull City. Arsenal will learn this morning whether Callum Chambers is available for tonight's Champions League group opener at Borussia Dortmund. Chambers has tonsillitis and is rated only 50-50 to start the match in place of Mathieu Debuchy, who is also facing an extended spell on the sidelines due to an ankle problem. Liverpool are back in the tournament after a 5-year absence. They have a home game at Anfield against the Bulgarian champions Ludogorets. They came through 3 qualifying rounds. And the Liverpool manager Brendan Rodgers believes that Mario Balotelli is poised to make a big impression on the tournament.
He's arguably one of the most experienced players that we have in terms of this level of competition, in terms of international calibre and at club level. So I think for him and the best players, they enjoy that responsibility. So I think it's one that I'm sure he's relishing, and he's been brought in here to do a job, which is to create goals and score goals and work hard.
Jerome Champagne has formally announced that he will stand against incumbent Sepp Blatter in next year's election for the presidency of FIFA. Blatter is seeking a 5th term as president. Leitrim have a new football manager. The appointment of Shane Ward was approved at a county board meeting last night. Ward led the county's under-21 team to the Connacht final this year, and he will retain his under-21 role as part of the new arrangement. Last night's homecoming for the All-Ireland Camogie Champions Cork was attended by an estimated crowd of 600 in Cork City. The celebrations later moved to Milford, home club of team captain Anna Geary. Tiger Woods has yet to swing a golf club since missing the cut at last month's US PGA Championship, but he reports his recovery from a back injury to be progressing well. Woods says a large volume of gym work has seen his strength return. The former world number one anticipates a full playing schedule next year. The first interprovincial rugby game of the Pro 12 season takes place in Galway on Friday night, with Connacht, who've won both their opening games, at home to Leinster. And the Leinster and Ireland prop Jack McGrath is glad to be back playing rugby for the new season.
We put in a tough pre-season, 7 weeks. I suppose when you're getting towards the end of that, you're probably a bit sick of all the running and no rugby. So you're itching to go when you do get a chance. So yeah, from that end, I'm pretty happy with how it's gone, and probably looking forward to having a go at Connacht this weekend, because it'll be a tough task.
They're coming off the back of 2 great wins for them, and particularly away to Edinburgh, and the fashion in which they managed to eke that out. What are your thoughts on them, and what's likely to be in prospect for you next Friday evening?
I think obviously they're going to be confident, 2 wins out of 2. Beating 2 teams that they finished below last season, they'll be delighted with that. And especially being at home this week, I think they always up the game for us. So we're going to have to really do our homework on them this week, and work away at our own jobs, our own small minor details going down there, because it's going to be really, really hard.
That's Jack McGrath speaking to Justin Tracy. Paul O'Connell, Dave Kilcoyne, Conor Murray and JJ Hanrahan are all available for selection for Munster's game against Zebre in Thomond Park also on Friday night, while Ulster are awaiting the results of scans to establish the extent of a knee injury suffered by scrum half Ruan Pienaar playing for South Africa in the Rugby Championship game against New Zealand in Wellington on Saturday. Donegal boxer Jason Quigley has announced that his next fight in his professional career will be in Boston on the 30th of October. His opponent still hasn't been finalised. The large Teague Hurdle is the feature at Listowel today, day 3 of the Harvest Festival. The Willie Mullins trained McKinley is expected to go off favourite. He'll be ridden by Johnny Burke, who has 3 winners so far at the festival. Tony McCoy will be in action there, riding Shutter Island for JP McManus. And Connections of Estimate have ruled out competing in the Melbourne Cup. A race at Ascot is now her most likely next outing.
Porrick, thank you very much. It's 22 minutes to 9 now. If you'd like to be what Coastwatch Ireland calls a citizen scientist, listen on. They're looking for volunteers to join thousands of other Europeans who'll be out auditing their local shores around low tide for the next month. The survey will gather vital information about the state of our coastal shores. Our reporter Petula Martin joined volunteers at Carlingford Lough yesterday as the first survey began.
This here is a peacock worm. So you can just see the little tube. Yeah. And when the tide comes further in, its body will come out of that little tube to feed. Okay. They're filter feeders.
And would you need to know that kind of knowledge to do the survey?
No, you wouldn't. And some of the information is on the forums as well, so it's quite easy to be able to identify these.
Sarah Clear works in environmental education and ecology, but today she's a volunteer at Carlingford Lough, filling in a questionnaire about what she sees on the shore.
Oh, we have a sea slater.
And we have tiny mussels, no crabs.
It wasn't called citizen science when it started in 1987, but it's now regarded as the longest-running citizen science survey in Ireland. Karen Dubsky is Coastwatch International Coordinator.
They have to go out onto the shore at low tide and walk 500 metres of shore and look out for a whole pile of different things which are on a questionnaire. It's basically like an audit of the shore where you're looking at a whole pile of things from hinterland, whether it's eroding or whether there's deposition or what's sitting there, over very interesting animals and plants in the intertidal, as we've just been doing.
Can anybody, can any ordinary person go out and take part in the survey?
Yes, absolutely. We really would love to have a good mix of people. And we have everything from schools, generally from sort of 11, 12 years old, you do it, to universities, to fishermen, like you, today you have Leo here, fisherman, to people who just walk the dock every day. They know that shore inside out, but they might have never noticed whether there are butterfish under the rocks or whether there are any limpets.
7,000 kilometres of coastline was mapped specifically for this survey and divided into 500 metre sections by Angel Duarte, the technical coordinator.
Takes a long time, a lot of patience. I use satellite imagery. And it's basically just drawing over the tide line. It requires a trained eye. It's not easy to say where it ends and where it starts, only on the satellite image, without not being able to go to the field.
Kayaking is a popular activity at Carlingford Adventure Centre. Co-owner Tom McArdle is taking part in the coastline survey. He's particularly interested in the litter audit of the survey. A clean, attractive coastline on Carlingford Lough is important for his business to thrive.
I certainly have a great interest in the coast. We have so many people taking part in water activities. We want to ensure that the water is clean and there's no contaminants in the water.
The Marine Institute in Galway also has a keen interest in the outcome of the Coast Watch survey. Joe Silk, Section Manager for Phytoplankton and Shellfish Safety, explains what they will be looking out for.
Our interest in my section of the Institute is red tides. So if we see any discoloration in the water from algal blooms, anything that may be unusual, we'd like to hear about it, and then we can send them out kits and get samples taken. It's great to have people all around the coast just taking samples, keeping aware and looking at what's going on in the sea.
And that's Joe Silk of the Marine Institute, ending that report by Petula Martin. And if you're interested in becoming a citizen scientist, also known as a volunteer, and taking part in that Coastwatch survey, just go to coastwatch.org for all the information about that. I've already tweeted a link to it.
Outside the window, upstairs here at an 18th century manor house and now Abbey Hotel in Roscommon, beside a small helicopter landing pad, the ruins of an outhouse. Not unlike the state of the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party after the last general election. In power for much of the last 100 years, just 20 TDs and 14 senators make up their parliamentary party, gathered here for their pre-Dáil think-in. Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin is with us now. Micheál Martin, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
3 years after that kicking in the general election, trailing three parties in the polls now, how would you assess the state of your party at the moment?
I think the party is in a much better state than it was in the immediate aftermath of the last general election. We've made very significant progress in terms of reforming the party and giving a greater say to members of the party. And the first fundamental test really was the local elections in May, and we actually ended up with the most votes and the most seats in that local election. And that allowed us to bring a new generation of councillors to the fore, in addition to those councillors we already had and who were re-elected. And that does create a platform for the future in terms of fresh blood and new ideas. And I think it's work in progress. We still have a significant journey, obviously, to travel in terms of the renewal of the party and the renewal of Irish politics itself, because Fianna Fáil is not an end in itself. And what we are about has to be more than just the party's own health. It has to be the broader health of the public. And therefore, we have to devise policies and ideas that can contribute to solutions to the problems and issues that face families and communities. And you've described our location here today, for example, and I've been here for the last number of weeks listening eagerly to people. This is a region that feels left behind, for example, in Roscommon and Leitrim and generally in the West, that don't feel they're participating in the economic recovery, which they think is two-tier, and which they feel has dramatically left them behind in terms of jobs, broadband capability, attack on small schools. And myself and Ivan Connaughton have been hearing that, our candidate in the by-election. We've been hearing that message. It's a very strong message. And they feel there's an absence of an overall vision, for example, for rural Ireland and for life outside of the big cities. And that's an important issue for all of us, even those of us who were born and reared in cities, in terms of how we have a more balanced country and how we can give sustainable futures to people. So that's really the ultimate objective of Fianna Fáil in itself, as we renew ourselves, that we bring people into politics who can contribute to that ideal and to that idea of helping people out there in communities.
You've had to spend 3 years trying to save the party from going under, and you stabilised that vote, as you said, in the local elections. But you stand accused of doing that, perhaps understandably, at the expense of developing policies. Is attacking the government or rubbishing the government's health policy your focus for this term?
Holding the government to account is a very important part of any opposition. And these issues are very serious indeed in terms of health. Because I've made the point that the government falsified the figures, for example, in the presentation of the last budget, and particularly in relation to medical cards. Now, there are many, many people and families out there who suffered very much indeed as a result of the withdrawal of medical cards. Very sick children, people in life-threatening conditions, with life-limiting conditions, lost their medical cards. And when I asked the Taoiseach week after week in the Dáil last year, he kept on denying that there was a change in government policy. As a result of revelations in the Sunday Independent last week, we now learn that they had a figure of 225,000 in terms of withdrawing medical cards. In other words, they were going to withdraw 225,000 medical cards. They didn't, because people lost the medical cards. They scrapped it after the local elections, when the people gave them a powerful message. It was uncaring, it was cruel what they were doing, but they did it under the radar. They attempted, to do it under the radar. They didn't front up in October last year.
They put in a figure called
the medical card probity figure, if you remember that, of 116 million. This was part of a savage cut of 666 million, in addition to another half a billion that was of a deficit that was coming in. They were not transparent in presenting that budget.
They didn't tell us their reservations. The Department of Health, the HSE, the Health Minister, the head of the HSE, all expressed reservations.
No one said on budget day, we're going to crucify you in health. No one said we're going to risk patient safety, which they did. I mean, we had the Beaumont CEO coming out only the last couple of weeks saying that patient safety is at risk in Beaumont Hospital. We had CEOs last year of four major hospitals in the aftermath of the budget, Crumlin, Talla, James's, that are all saying that patient safety is now at risk. I mean, they're playing around with people's health and lives here. And I think the lesson from it is, in the preparation of this budget, is we need a very transparent approach to the budgeting of health now. Because we can't trust this government.
You were Minister for Health for many years. Did you ever stay within your budget in any given year?
We actually accepted that if medicines were required, for example, on a demand-led basis, we didn't cut the medicines. We allowed patients to have the medicines.
So even at a time when you had increased budgets, you were overshooting your budget every year too.
But it was a policy, and correct policy, to make sure that patients were treated. In other words, we didn't put a ceiling on the number of people that would come in. And as a result, if you look through the figures in my time, the number of inpatients treated goes up dramatically between 2000 and 2004. So we treated far more people during that period, as was correct. Now, I acknowledge there are difficulties now. And it's not the fact that there's a deficit I'm criticising. It's the fact that they hid the truth from the people in relation to health. And they cut medical cards from very needy families. It was a disgrace what happened. And every single TD, irrespective of party, acknowledged that. But it took them until after the local elections to admit it and then change tack. But by the way, when we say change tack, it is still happening.
Okay.
People over 70 with very serious conditions right now are losing their medical cards as a result of this continuous policy to try and pull it back from people on an individual basis.
The next election won't see Fianna Fáil getting back into power. Absolutely not. The public aren't ready for it. So says your former cabinet colleague and now councillor for Fianna Fáil, Mary Hannafin. Is she right?
She's not right, and I don't accept her analysis at all. Because I think if we're honest and look at it objectively, it's a very fragmented political landscape now, particularly coming out of the local elections, if you look at what happened between independents and the various political parties. So it's impossible for anybody to predict who is going to come out of the next general election in terms of either going into government or going into opposition.
Are you going to be the next Taoiseach? Are you preparing to be the next Taoiseach?
I am preparing to be the next Taoiseach. That is our obligation, and also as a political party, we are going to prepare very specific ideas and policies and position ourselves in a way that makes it gives the public a clear choice in terms of the kind of society that we want in over the next 5 to 6 years. And critical areas like education and health and enterprise for Irish people. In other words, that we need a far more dynamic focus on creating an environment for young Irish people and people generally to set up their own companies, their own businesses. That's not there to the degree that it should be at the moment. We need far greater degree of public investment, for example, in education and in social housing. This government, for some reason over the last 3 years, has deliberately underspent its own capital estimates and capital provision, with the result that there could have been, even within the very straitened circumstances, better public investment in terms of infrastructure, in terms of schools, in terms of our universities and institutes of technology, which has not happened. And that's a failure to invest in the future. And those are the kind of areas that I would focus in on. And then there's the big issue of health. We now know that the government's universal health insurance plan was a farce from day one. Was that they lived a lie for 3 years. They never had any intention of implementing it. Therefore, it falls now to ourselves and others to come up with alternative ideas about health in terms of how best to provide care for all.
If you're going to be Taoiseach or indeed part of the next government, it's unlikely you're going to be able to do it on your own. I think any analysis of opinion polls would have to be very optimistic to see Fianna Fáil returning to power on its own. Who are you going to go into power with?
Well, as far as we're concerned right now, we haven't made any decision in terms of that. Because
are you ruling out going into government with Fine Gael?
Quite simply, it's a matter for the public to decide in the first instance how much, just to make my point, how much support they're going to give to each political party.
Yes.
I've always said from day one that my fundamental litmus test is that we must, if we have a set of policies and a blueprint, we want those implemented, not at any cost. And if we have to do it from the opposition, we do it from the opposition. If we do it from in government, we do it from in government.
Will you
at
rule
the moment,
out going into government?
We're not going in with Fine Gael. We're not happy with Fine Gael's policies
will
at the
rule
moment.
It out?
Just could I just make the point that the Fine Gael have gone very right wing, Gavin. They seem to have carved out a particular niche for themselves, as a result of which low-income and low-income working families and middle-income working families are suffering grievously at the hands of Fine Gael. And a lot of their policies in terms of their budgetary policies has impacted.
I'm still not
so the answer
and
is no, I'm not going into Fine Gael, no.
Will you rule it out?
I have ruled it out, yes.
You've ruled
not
out going
into
Fine Gael.
Fine Gael. Yes,
In terms of the numbers of candidates or the types of candidates that you're going to need to stand in the next election, why are you finding it so difficult to attract women to the party?
Well, there's been a number of challenges, and even I think fundamentally there's an issue with the Dáil itself in terms of how the Dáil operates. It's not attractive to women.
They all have women TDs, you don't.
Well,
are you
finding
it hard
we suffered an enormous loss in the last general election, and disproportionately that impacted on women. We're going to increase that for the next general election in terms of the number of candidates we have. And it is a challenge for the party, Gavin. I accept that. And I've gone to the membership of the party and I've said, we have to, as part of our renewal, increase the number of women in terms of Dáil candidates, and not just Dáil candidates but across the board in terms of officerships within the party. And we have a session today now with Yvonne Galligan in terms of a gender equality commission which we've established to bring it home to the party, the realities, but also what it needs to be done in order to make sure we have more women standing for us. And we will have more women standing for us in the next general election, and hopefully we will have more women TDs and senators coming out of the next general election.
Micheál Martin, leader of Fianna Fáil, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning.